news this past week. Locally, there has been some developments, some disturbing developments, if I must say, and a lot of people are discussing about the situation in Mozambique, neighboring Mozambique, and there's been a lot of distortion in the media, we would say dramatic news coverage. We hear in terms been, you know, the again, those exotic superlatives, you know, been swear words, we can say, being thrown around: Islamist terrorists, Islamist insurgents, Islamist this, Islamist that, and it just gets on and on. And sadly, the Institute of Security Studies here in South Africa, which in my view is a captured institute, especially by the Zionist lobby here in South Africa, is painting a very grim, scary picture here, scaremongering picture, making it seem that what is happening in neighboring Mozambique is going to destabilize the entire Southern African region. And the thing is that, firstly, let's look at it in context and what's going on there, that this current situation in Mozambique is it's quite contained to that Cabo Delgado province, which is in the northernmost part of the country bordering Tanzania, and it's also the poorest province in the country. And there's a reason, and I touched on this last week, as to why this sort of thing is happening. The scenario here, it's a very simple analysis, in the sense that you had in 2017 the government of Mozambique signed lucrative gas mining deals with Russian companies, as well as later on Total from France came in to mine that area, and of course exploit the area as well, because you must know, when you mine, you're exploiting the area, exploiting the region, and in order for those things to materialize, you need to clear the area of the inhabitants, of the indigenous people. And the indigenous people, majority of whom in that province are Muslim, are resisting because they got nowhere else to go. And, well, they standing up for their rights, and rightfully so. So that's what's been taking place there. And because they happen to be Muslim, so then, of course, all these superlatives come up, you know, Islamist terrorists, etc., right? Yes, of course, what happens in cases like this, you'll get opportunistic forces, you know, like maybe whether the Al-Qaeda, whether the Al-Shabaab or ISIS or whoever, that will creep in and will exploit the situation to their advantage and put the blame on an entire religion, on an entire community, etc. And what the media is failing to mention is that the victims of the trouble here in that region, apart from the employees and those who are linked to all these mining companies and companies that provide services to these mining companies and oil companies, such as the South African who passed away the other week, are the people. And the people are majority Muslims. So you talk about Islamist terrorists, but what about the Islamist victims? What about those Muslim victims? And an interesting article appeared in this week's Daily Maverick by a correspondent called Joseph Hannon, who said that Mozambique's Frelimo, which is the ruling party, gambled everything on gas and lost, right? He says that the leadership of the Mozambique's ruling party, which is the Frelimo, was dazzled by gas. The discovery of the second largest gas reserves in Africa back in 2010 led the political and business elite to believe Mozambique would become like Abu Dhabi, Qatar or Kuwait, and gas would make them fabulously wealthy and the riches would trickle down to ordinary people. Poverty and inequality were increasing, but there was no reason to spend money on rural development because the gas bonanza would end poverty. Of course, the elites could take their share early, such as with the $2 billion secret debt in 2012. Right, the gas windfall would benefit everyone by 2020. This is according to their estimates, right? Delayed to maybe 2025, at the most to 2030. The people would believe the dreams. However, in Cabo Delgado, they did not. And an insurgency began in 2017 over growing poverty and inequality, as well as political and economic exclusion. There is broad agreement. Well, that's subject to opinion. There is broad agreement that Al-Shabaab, as the insurgents are known in Mozambique, and this is not the Al-Shabaab of Al-Shabaab of Somalia, initially comprised local people with local leadership. Whether the Islamic State that now controls this Al-Shabaab is a matter of huge debate, and rightfully so. But even advocates of this view accept that it took over an existing local insurgency. Local people saw the development of a ruby mine in the province and the initial gas development and realized there were no jobs for them. The gas and ruby money was not trickling down to them. The predictions were fabulous. In 2015, it was confidently predicted that gas production would start in 2019 with liquefied natural gas known as LNG production reaching 100 million tons a year, metric tons a year. Government revenue would be about $95 billion over 25 years, almost doubling the current government expenditure of $3.5 billion a year. The first profits were made by small energy companies selling out to bigger ones, and three multinational giants now control the gas. ExxonMobil of America is the lead company for the far offshore half of the gas field, along with Eni, Eni of Italy, and Total of France that leads the half closest to the coast. So this is what's been happening. I'm not going to go further on this. Basically, it says here that there's been exploitation and nothing, no jobs for the people and no benefit for the people for their local economy. Now, this is all has to do with what we're familiar here in South Africa with a patronage system. In Mozambique, the government, Frelimo, and business are the same people, led by a handful of oligarchs who are surrounded by a penumbra of the Frelimo elite. We know we have also here in South Africa the ANC elite. They control contracts, land and licenses and thus the economy. Frelimo is now run entirely according to a patron-client system. Again, sounds familiar. At each level, people service those above them, demand obeisance from those below and collect money from whatever they are involved in. The system is known locally as goatism, G-O-A-T-I-S-M, goatism. From the saying, the goat eats where it is tethered. The police set up checkpoints to collect money, clerks demand a fee to process a document, and so on. School teachers must satisfy their school head by working actively on elections, but in exchange, they can demand bribes from pupils and parents and do not have to show up to teach. In these circumstances, gas became the great promise and gamble. The patron-client system was kept working by promises of gas money, cash as early as 2012 for those linked to the $2 billion secret debt. From 2015, contracts for hotel rooms, transport, and a myriad of services for the gas companies, as well as mandatory shares in gas-linked foreign investment projects, were into the local Frelimo fixes. For others, the gas bonanza was always just around the corner. Like all good con artists, those at the top had to keep everyone believing the big payoff was coming. Frelimo's gamble was that, like a juggler, it could keep the balls in the air, hoping that no one noticed that the project was shrinking and delayed. With no money for development and growing wealth at the top, poverty and inequality increased. But in the past 2 years, four things have changed. Environmental concerns, global politics, the market and war. The gas project projections were done assuming wells would pump for 30 years to 2060, thus long-term profits were measured. So that's what's been happening. As we said, political patronage-linked system, and this is the reality, the sick reality of what's been happening in Mozambique. But they come into another story that one would ask if this was a bit abusing or was this special privilege. But yesterday it has emerged that Jacob Zuma, the former president of South Africa, has been given until Wednesday to propose an appropriate sentence if he's found guilty. Now, we all know that the Zondo Commission has taken Jacob Zuma to the Constitutional Court for the violation of a constitutional court order that he appear in front of the Zondo Commission, and he's flatly refused to do so. So the Zondo Commission is exercising its right for the contempt of court charge be enforced, and that they want a prison sentence. So Zuma's lawyer has confirmed that he received a letter from the Chief Justice Mogoeng giving Zuma until Wednesday to reply with an affidavit of not more than 15 pages. Right now, the thing is, what's extraordinary here, or one would call privilege, but nevertheless, it's none of those, is that why would Zuma be given have to write in the sense that if he's found guilty, right? The thing is that one has to understand, when in a normal courtroom scenario, when a person is found guilty and then it's then the sentencing hearing comes about. The defense is always given an opportunity to mitigate sentencing for the most lenient or the lightest sentence. So, but that is done in court because the defense is present in court. However, in this case, Jacob Zuma has refused to go to court, even for the part of prior to the Easter weekend when the matter was heard at the Constitutional Court. He did not, he was not present himself. However, his legal representatives were there. So therefore, Judge Mogoeng has asked him that if you are found guilty, tell me what sort of sentence would you feel is appropriate to you. And that's what it is in simple layman's terms. And looking at this, it's a matter of, well, one would say it's, of course, there has been special privilege. You can see in many of the cases, like take for example when Ace Magashule was charged. He did not go overnight to jail or even go spend a few hours, you know, go sit in that slammer for a while. Well, it happened to former Durban Mayor Zandile Gumede, but nevertheless, till they formally charged, etc., and he was given a chance to go to court and make an appearance. So the thing is that this is the type of scenario. Yes, they are heavyweight politicians, so they will be awarded a certain degree of privilege, and there's nothing we can do about it. So let's look at what it's the outcome and see what happens next. So what's been happening recently in the news is that a very disturbing development took place this past weekend. And many of you must have heard about it. And I was a bit annoyed about it personally because I felt that at the end of the day, I mean, this is not appropriate in today's time here in this scenario here in the non-racial South Africa that we are in, or the new South Africa, even though 27 years later, right? And what was what's this all about is that Tony Leon, who has been the arrogant racist, you can say, although he denies not that he's not although he denies being a racist, but at the end of the day, his modus operandi and his ways and his style says a lot to be desired. And you must also know that he's the chief proponent of the Zionist lobby here in South Africa and extremely pro-Israel. But put the pro-Israel side part of aspect of him aside, right? That Tony Leon, who was supposed to have been out of the DA long ago, well, he's officially out of the DA, but unofficially, he's still very much part of the DA. And if you've seen what he's been saying lately in the papers, especially, funny enough, defending Mogoeng, the former chief, Mogoeng, the chief justice in the matter about his pro-Israel comments, etc. And now he's said something very disturbing this past weekend that Musi Maimane, who was the former leader of the DA, who was sidelined by Helen Zille when she made her comeback in the latter part of 2019, right? And he was humiliated and, of course, forced to, you know, step down and leave the DA. Tony Leon has said that Musi Maimane was an experiment gone wrong. Now, how can one be so absurd to say something like that? That particular words of experiment gone wrong were actually words used by a slave trader leader when they took Africans from Africa to America. And he's actually repeating these words. So Musi Maimane has responded to that and says that he finds the comment experiment gone wrong to be offensive. And he says that given that these remarks were a stark reminder that South Africa had a long way to go in building a non-racial country. He hit back at the former DA leader after he referred to after he was being referred to as this experiment gone wrong, right? Maimane has described Leon's statement as dehumanizing and deeply offensive, right? The former DA leader said that he left the party because his attempts to transform the organization failed. What attempts did you make to transform the organization? If anything, the organization has just proven itself to serve white interest. And no matter what one has to say, yes, you make all the right noises in parliament, you make all the statements that we want to hear, right? But at the end of the day, you are serving those interests. When you run Cape Town, you will make sure you run Cape Town to the best to prove to the rest of South Africa we can do it. The same will apply to the Western Cape legislature. You will make sure that you will run that province the best because you have something to prove to the rest of South Africa. However, let the fact remain is that the DA is still a very much a white party. And with Helen Zille making no surprise with her comeback in the latter part of 2019, don't be surprised with Tony Leon's comeback. Because at the end of the day, even if he's officially out of the DA, he's very much unofficially pulling the strings, like how you control puppets at a puppet string show. So that's what's been the developments here on the local political scene. Well, internationally, well, it's been a relatively quiet week. There have been some developments such as Islamophobia in France, right? No stranger to that. Well, actually, there have been two major developments on the matter in France. One is most of you have heard that there's a popular French news media outlet known as Le Figaro, which is actually a French daily newspaper. And the editorial room of this paper decided to introduce the practice of cupping, right, which is a sunnah amongst Muslims. But cupping is not only confined to Muslims, because cupping has its roots actually in China and started before the birth of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So they have decided to introduce the practice of cupping therapy to its audience. And to make matters worse, they actually described the cupping, right, which is used by a lot of athletes and celebrities throughout the world, as hell of Islamic exorcism, which is spreading in France, right? So La Figaro, which presents itself as the serious media outlet, had left many doubt in its integrity and common sense. As I said, cupping therapy is widely used by many people around the world. It is also popular amongst celebrities who happen to be white, Christian, non-Muslim, or Jewish, etc., such as Justin Bieber and Madonna. However, the French newspaper opted to cover the story from a controversial angle. And as I said, the article was titled In the Hell of Islamic Exorcism Spreading in France. It informed its readers about a Muslim prophetic medicine that has been developed in the strictest secrecy for several years. The newspaper highlighted that the therapy was created under the guise of severity. And quoting from this article, he says, when the advice of friends and the love of a family are powerless, when reason has become the slave of passion, or relationship problems multiply, ruqya becomes necessary. The author writes, making reference to migraines, depression, evil eye, and witchcraft. Went further on to say, there are many ailments that this Islamic exorcism claims to cure. The article said, alleging that the creators of the cupping therapy promote self-healing through trust in Allah. The newspaper warned its readers that the practice was a cause of concern for French authorities, prompting confused social media users to question the atmosphere in which this article was written. Right? So some reactions have been coming out. So one person says, it's almost admirable that even in the midst of a genuine public health and medical emergency, Le Figaro have the enduring capacity to find the real Islamist health conspiracy that is destroying the Fifth Republic, one cup at a time. This is according to an EU correspondent for the Financial Times, Mahrin Khan, who wrote on Twitter handle on Tuesday. Right, so this is what it is, that they're actually saying that cupping, which started in China, and the Chinese practice cupping, they do both dry and wet cupping on a bigger scale than Sunnah cupping, right, is Islamist exorcism, or hell of Islamist exorcism. These French really, really see, they are really truly Islamophobic in nature, and it doesn't stop there. And we touched on this last week, and again, the usual bashing. First it was the burkini. First it was the niqab, which they call the burqa. Then it was a burkini. Now it's the hijab. So the bid by the French Senate to ban girls under 18 from wearing the hijab in public has drawn condemnation, with the hashtag hands off my hijab circulating widely on social media. We know that the hijab is a headscarf worn by many Muslim women and has been the subject of a decades-long feud in France. The French Senate move comes as part of Paris's push to introduce a so-called anti-separatism bill, which it says aims to bolster the country's secular system, but critics have denounced, arguing it singles out the minority Muslim population, which numbers 6 million, by the way, right? The ban is not yet law, with France's National Assembly required to sign off on the change before it can take effect. But a backlash to the amendment was swift, with some suggesting the proposed rule amounted to a law against Islam. Now, strange enough, age to consent to sex in France is 15 years of age, but the age to consent to hijab is 18. And let that sink in. It isn't a law against the hijab, it's a law against Islam. Hands off my hijab or France hijab ban, one Twitter user mentioned. Another posted, I thought we already had this covered. Forcing a woman to wear a hijab is wrong. Just like forcing her to take it off is wrong. It's her choice. The issue also attracted the attention of several high-profile figures. On Instagram, Olympic athlete Ibtihaj Muhammad shared a post suggesting the Senate's amendment indicated Islamophobia is deepening in France. This is what happens when you normalize anti-Islamic and anti-Muslim hate speech, bias, discrimination and hate crimes. Islamophobia is now written into law, the post said. So this is what's happening, and France is really rearing its ugly head in Islamophobia, and they were not going to stop this. As I said, they started with the ban on the burqa, which we call the niqab. They've then followed by the burkini. You can't go to the beach or to a public swimming pool wearing a burkini, but you can wear your underwear in public, which they call bikini, right? And now the ban on the hijab, as well as not to forget the Charlie Hebdo's continuous insults of our beloved Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and what Macron or President Moron, as what AB and I refer to, always says, it's French freedom and values. And just north of France, where we have Great Britain, the once Great Britain, which is not so great anymore, however, still controls the world, right? Not so long ago, they released a report, the government of Britain released a report that they don't see Islamophobia to be a serious issue. In fact, they don't recognize that policies and what's been happening causes Islamophobia. So totally in denial. And, the daughter of a grandfather who was retired by the name of Mohammed Salim, who on the night of 29th of April in 2013 was walking home from the masjid, right, in Birmingham. At 82, he was using his walking stick. Suddenly, a Ukrainian PhD student, this person was supposed to be educated, right, at the age of 25 at the time, Pavlo Lapshin, stabbed the elderly man 3 times in the back with a hunting knife, killing him. The wound that was highest up on passed all the way through his body. In June and July, Lapshin, white supremacists were wanted, in his words, to increase racial conflict, planted bombs outside 3 mosques in the West Midlands region, targeting the busiest periods of Friday Juma prayers. He was later arrested and pleaded guilty to all the charges against him under the Explosive Substances Act of 1883 and the Terrorism Act of 2006. He is now serving at least 40 years in a UK prison. Now, Sir Mohammed Salim's gruesome murder, which Lapshin carried out just 5 days after arriving in the UK on a work visa, devastated Britain's Muslim community. More than 5,000 people attended his funeral. But according to Mohammed Salim's daughter, Maaz Salim, more needs to be done to recognize Islamophobia as a dangerous phenomenon. She is now calling on the UK government to officially recognize Islamophobia as a crime. We need to bring Islamophobia back to the table, right? Islamophobia has been rising longer than the so-called war on terror. Muslims get attacked for the way they look and dress. So this is what's been happening, and staying on that, on Islamophobia, when it comes to the social media giants, I mentioned the other week that the 3 social media giants of Google, Facebook and Twitter had to appear in front of the US Senate committee to explain how they're dealing with hate speeches on their platforms, right? So an advocacy group for Muslim Americans sued Facebook, alleging that the company's failure to enforce its own moderation policies has caused a wave of anti-Muslim abuse. The complaint filed in Superior Court in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, claims the world's largest social network has failed to remove content that violates its rules against hate speech, despite assuring lawmakers and other government officials that it enforces those policies. Facebook, Twitter, and Google's YouTube have generally been able to dodge lawsuits, faulting them for not removing abusive content under a 1996 federal law that broadly protects internet platforms from liability for content posted by users. But in this case, the nonprofit group Muslim Advocates claims that Facebook officials breached a local consumer protection law by falsely promising that the company would remove content and that ran afoul of its moderation standards. Every day, ordinary people are bombarded with harmful content that violates Facebook's own policies on hate speech, bullying, harassment, dangerous organizations, and violence, according to the lawsuit. Hateful anti-Muslim attacks are especially perversive. A Facebook spokesman said in a statement, "We do not allow hate speech on Facebook and regularly work with experts, nonprofits, stakeholders to help make sure Facebook is a safe place for everyone. Recognizing anti-Muslim rhetoric can take different forms." So the spokesperson said the company invests in artificial intelligence technologies to detect and remove hate speech on its platforms. But however, Muslim Advocates, which is based in Washington, D.C., is one of several civil rights organizations that have repeatedly called on Facebook to do more to eliminate anti-Muslim bigotry and white supremacist content. Days after the Capitol riot in January, the group urged Facebook to permanently kick outgoing President Donald Trump off its platform for spreading white nationalist hate and conspiracy theories. Muslim Advocates says it presented Facebook in 2017, with a list of 26 groups whose pages violate the company's community standards. As of this month, 18 of the 26 groups still had pages available on Facebook, according to the complaint. The advocacy group is seeking monetary damages as well as a court declaration that Facebook broke the law in Washington. So that's been happening on the Islamophobia side. However, no stranger to Islamophobia is the state of Israel, of course. And yesterday, being the 9th of April, marked 73 years of the Deir Yassin massacre. So I want to talk about the Deir Yassin massacre, right? As I said, it was 73 years ago that some 120 members of the underground Jewish right-wing militia groups invaded the Palestinian Arab village of Deir Yassin. You must know, on the 9th of April 1948, which was roughly about a month before the so-called birth of the State of Israel, or should we say a month before the birth of the illegitimate State of Israel, right? So on the 9th of April 1948, there's 120 Jewish militia, right, invaded the Arab village of Deir Yassin, killing 100 to 250 people, including men, women, children, and the elderly, with reports of mutilations, rapes, and survivors being paraded through Jewish neighborhoods before being summarily executed. The massacre remains one of the most brutal in the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Over 7 decades later, Palestinians continue to be killed with apparent impunity as ongoing events in the Gaza Strip demonstrate. Right? So this is where it happened. Now, Deir Yassin, as I said, took place on the 9th of April 1948. And where is Deir Yassin situated? It's a village on the outskirts of West Jerusalem. You must know, today West Jerusalem is a Jewish neighborhood, while East Jerusalem is supposed to be an Arab neighborhood. However, as you know, with settler policy, etc., a lot of East Jerusalem is being annexed day by day. So what exactly took place? The massacre took place against the backdrop of a bitter conflict that preceded the end of the British mandate in Palestine. Just months before, in November 1947, the UN had proposed the division of Palestine into an Arab state and a Jewish state, with Jerusalem administered independently of either side by an international body. The Arabs rejected the UN proposal and the conflict became even more intense. Deir Yassin was a peaceful village of about 400 people, right, that had signed a non-aggression pact and was excluded from clashes elsewhere. Due to its proximity to West Jerusalem, it came under the UN partition plan as part of the independent Jerusalem area. The Jewish forces that invaded DRC belonged mainly to two extremist underground paramilitary groups, the Irgun, which is known as the National Military Organization, and the Lehi, Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, also known as the Stern Gang, both of which were aligned with the right-wing Zionist movement. They have been described as Jewish terrorists. Yes, back then, the British described them as Jewish terrorists. And I'll elaborate on that just now. The two groups attacked the village in order to clear the road to Jerusalem of its Arab inhabitants, as well as send a message to the other Palestinians in the region, the Palmach, a unit of the Haganah, the forerunner of the Israeli Defense Forces, whose leadership was aligned with the political left, also took part in the massacre to a lesser degree. So, you know, when you hear from about Israel politics, left-wing, right-wing, centrist-right, centrist-left, they're all the same. It's just that it's different shades of grey. They all have one agenda, and that is to make life for the Palestinians a living hell. The attack force consisted of some 120 fighters who met for a briefing on the morning before the massacre. Those present later described the atmosphere amongst the militants as festive as they prepared to massacre Palestinians in their homes. They arrived at the edge of the village at 4:30 a.m. where they took up positions and started firing at residents. Whilst the Jewish groups had expected the Palestinians to flee, the residents did not foresee the attack to be an attempt to kill them or drive them all away. They thought that it was just a raid and refused to run. The militias entered the village, shooting at those in the street and throwing hand grenades into houses, destroying buildings and killing the residents who were hiding inside. Eyewitnesses, including fighters from the Haganah, testified to seeing Irgun and Lehi troops pillaging houses and corpses, stealing money and jewelry from the survivors and burning corpses. There were also multiple reports of rape and mutilation, as well as an account that villagers were killed after being taken away on a victory parade through Jewish neighborhoods in West Jerusalem. What happened thereafter? Well, the Arab Emergency Committee in Jerusalem learned of the attack at around 9 a.m. on the same day, despite appealing for the British army, who was still ruling Palestine, by the way, to intervene to protect civilians. The British Mandate authorities were not keen to face the Jewish militias. General Sir Gordon MacMillan, the commander of the British forces in Palestine, stated infamously that he would risk British lives only for British interests. Them ruling on Palestine, their mandate on Palestine, which never came to an end until a month later, that means they were responsible for Palestine. So that means that this was a British interest, said that he would not risk British or he would only risk British lives for British interests. 2 days after the massacre, Jacques de Reynier, head of the International Committee of the Red Cross Delegation Palestine, visited Deir Yassin. In his personal memoirs published in 1950, that was about 2 years later, he recalled seeing the bodies of over 200 dead men, women and children. One body was a woman who must have been 8 months pregnant, hit in the stomach with powder burns on her dress, indicating that she'd been shot point blank. How gruesome is that? On 14th April, 5 days later, Assistant Inspector General Richard Keating of the British Palestine Police conducted interviews with female survivors of the massacre taking refuge in the nearby Palestinian town of Silwan. In a subsequent report, he included that there was no doubt that the Jewish groups had committed numerous sexual atrocities, including rape against the villagers. Many young schoolgirls were raped and later slaughtered. Old women were also molested. One story is current concerning a case in which a young lady was literally torn in two. Many infants were also butchered and killed. I also saw one old woman who gave her age as 104 who had been severely beaten up about the head with rifle butts. So they beat an 104-year-old woman with the butt of a rifle on the head. News of the indiscriminate killing sparked terror amongst Palestinians, causing many to flee from their towns and villages in the face of Jewish advances. With the news of other atrocities in Haifa and Yaffa, public anger in the Arab world rose to new heights over the following month as they demanded that their governments should take action. Consequently, on 15 May 1948, one day after the British Mandate ended, and Israel declared its independence, several Arab armies invaded and the 1948 Arab-Israeli War began. the aftermath. After the war ended in 1949, the Jewish neighborhood of Giyat Shol Bet was built on what used to be Deir Yassin, despite protests and requests that it be left uninhabited. Today, it is part of Har Nof, an Orthodox Jewish area. Although the two main groups responsible for the massacre were considered underground extremist militias, both their leaders, Menachem Begin, who signed the Camp David Accords with Anwar Sadat of Egypt, of the Irgun, and Yitzhak Shamir, who was later on Prime Minister of Israel as well in the latter part of the 80s, of the Stern Gang, later became, as I said, Prime Ministers of Israel. Right? Today, Israel, and just let me just pause there, right, that another member of this Irgun gang was Benjamin Ram, and another member was Benjamin Netanyahu's father. But who was Benjamin Ram? He, all of you knew, when Barack Obama was elected president of the United States, he brought in a Jewish person by the name of Ram Emanuel as his chief of staff, as the White House chief of staff. Benjamin Ram was the father of, or is the father of, Ram Emanuel. I'm not sure if he's alive still, but he was very much part of Irgun. Him, together with Menachem Begin, Benjamin Netanyahu's father, Yitzhak Shamir, were all part of this of Irgun and the Stern Gang, right? And after that, he went to America, Benjamin Ram, and moved over to Chicago, right, to finish medicine, studying medicine, and he became a pediatrician. A pediatrician who has got no conscience, who's got blood on his hands for a massacre which his movement took was responsible for, where infants were being slaughtered, and he becomes a pediatrician. What sick absurdity that! And he was also honored by the state of, or blessed with an honorary award by the city of Chicago several years later for his services to the community. And funny enough, Ram Emanuel is the mayor of Chicago. So after he left the White House. So we all know that today Israel still continues to kill Palestinians with apparent impunity. Outrage from the international community is generally limited to condemnations on global platforms, right? And it will be another 73, 75 years, right? That one can foresee this happening. Only Allah knows best. And the past year has been an insult to the Palestinian cause, especially with Donald Trump's push and his son-in-law Jared Kushner involved in this, for the push of normalization with certain Arab countries such as the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Well, it's very sad, and staying with Israel, or Palestine, I should say, or the illegitimate state of Israel, Israeli police yesterday restricted the entry again of hundreds of Muslim worshippers to the old city, right, so they could go to Al-Aqsa Masjid for Jummah prayers. They prevented 300 Palestinians residing in the West Bank from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque for Jummah prayers on the grounds that they did not have permission. This is what the police statement said. Police performed identity checks on Palestinians at the gates of the old city beginning yesterday morning. Security forces then sent the Palestinians back to the West Bank by buses. So Palestinians who are living in the occupied West Bank or the blockaded Gaza Strip, as we know, must get permission from the Israeli authorities to enter Jerusalem, even to go and make Salah at Al-Aqsa. Again, another development. Israel plans to tell the International Criminal Court, the ICC, that it does not recognize the authority of the tribunal, which is planning to investigate possible war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. This is according to Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, after meeting with senior ministers and government officials before a Friday deadline to respond to an ICC notification letter, said Israel will not cooperate with the inquiry, but it will send a response. In his words, it will be made clear that Israel is a country with a rule of law, God knows what that is, that knows how to investigate itself. Really? He said in a statement on Thursday, the response will also say Israel completely rejects the assertion that it carried out any war crimes. Well, we're not surprised. The statement added that the ICC has no powers to initiate an investigation against Israel and will not cooperate with it. Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute and that established the ICC, and therefore, by definition, not a party to the court. ICC prosecutors, who named groups on both the Israeli and Palestinian sides as possible perpetrators, said letters had been sent on March 9 to all parties concerned, giving them a month to inform the court if they were conducting their own investigations of the alleged crimes and want an ICC inquiry deferred while it is continuing. While that is continuing, the world's only permanent war crimes tribunal, the ICC, was set up in 2002 to try humanity's worst crimes where local courts were unwilling to or unable to step in. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has said her probe will cover the situation since 2014 in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem. It will mainly focus on the 2014 Gaza war, but also look at the deaths of Palestinian demonstrators from 2018 onwards. After a five-year preliminary probe, Fatou Bensouda said there was a reasonable basis to believe crimes were committed by both sides, by the Israeli military, Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip since 2007, other Palestinian armed groups. Well, at the end of the day, let's see what comes out of this. And looking at a country that is obviously trying to mimic or copy what Israel is doing is the RSS control regime of Narendra Modi under the BJP party, that just this week, a court in India's UP Uttar Pradesh state has passed an order related to a dispute over a centuries-old masjid and a temple situated next to each other, a case reminiscent of a similar and bloody dispute in the town of Ayodhya, which was resolved in 2019. The court in the city or the town of Varanasi on Thursday directed the Archaeological Survey of India to find out whether the centuries-old Gyanvapi masjid standing at present at the disputed site, in inverted commas, is a superimposition, alteration, addition, or there is a structural overlapping of any kind with or over any other religious structure, effectively meaning the adjacent Kashi Vishwanath temple. The court's decision followed petitions filed by right-wing Hindu groups, which claimed that the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb demolished a portion of the temple to build a mosque in the 17th century. The court ordered a five-member committee comprising of two Hindus, two Muslims, and an archaeological expert to oversee the comprehensive physical survey, setting May 31st as the date for the next hearing. Varanasi is also the parliamentary constituency of Modi, whose Hindu nationalist BJP power came to prominence as a political force in the 80s through a movement to build a Ram temple in Ayodhya, which is about 230 kilometers away in the same state. In Varanasi too, Modi's government is overseeing the construction of a huge project to showcase the Vishwanath temple, which has led to the demolition of century-old smaller temples and other structures in the oldest parts of the city. Like Ayodhya, the dispute in Varanasi is also decades old and first reached the court in 1991 when Hindu priests sought permission to worship in the Gyanvapi Masjid area. The dispute forced the then federal government to pass the Places of Worship Special Provincial Act in 1991, which prevented the conflagration of religious disputes similar to the Babri Masjid Ram temple issue. The law prohibited the alteration of all religious places as they existed on the August 15, 1947, the day India gained independence from British rule. In other words, the status quo remains for all religious places of worship in India to have to remain as is. If it's a masjid, it remains a masjid. If it's a church, it's a church. If it's a temple, it's a temple. Before we wrap up, just quick developments. It seems that Saudi Arabia, with the war in Yemen, has been spending so much of money that they're unable to pay their bills. And one of the companies that are crying foul is a company that they've been very close to, which is linked to Dick Cheney, which is the Bechtel Group. Amongst other companies are, of course, the Carlyle Group, Halliburton, etc. So the US-based Bechtel Group and other international firms are pursuing billions of dollars in unpaid bills from Saudi Arabia's government for work done on the Riyadh Metro project, according to five people familiar with the matter. Bechtel is owed around $1 billion for the transport system, a cornerstone of the government's efforts to upgrade the traffic-clogged Saudi capital. According to four of the people, Companies working on the project, which also involves French, Spanish and Italian firms, are pursuing several billions of dollars in unpaid bills in total, two of the people said, what Bechtel owed the most. The overdue payments are related in part to construction delays and cost overruns caused by the coronavirus pandemic, which trapped some workers outside the kingdom and made it difficult to continue the pace of work on the project, three of the people said. The payments dispute took on diplomatic overtones last year when the American, French, Spanish embassies in Riyadh raised the matter in a letter to the Saudi government, two of the people said. Government contractors have complained for years about overdue payments since a 2015 oil price slump led authorities to withhold tens of billions of dollars to help rein in a ballooning budget deficit. While that decision helped to keep a lid on state spending, it dented the confidence of the private sector that relies heavily on government contracts. Officials say they're committed to paying on time and have taken significant steps to resolve the problem, but the crash in the crude price prices last year appears to have led to similar delays for some companies, though the problem is less systematic than before. Bechtel didn't respond to a request for comment. The Royal Commission for Riyadh City, which oversees the project, said in a statement that payments to contractors have been made in a timely manner and the aforementioned claims are being assessed as per a dispute resolution process stipulated within the contract. Other companies involved in the project include Spain's Fomento de Construcciones, the Contractors SA, UK's WS Atkins Limited, and Italy's Salini Impreglio SPA, which have been rebranded as Webuild. The Riyadh Metro is key to MBS's plans to double the size of the city and turn it into an international business hub. It's amongst the largest projects of this type in the world, with six lines being built by three consortia, and is about 90% complete. Well, that's what it is. Saudi Arabia can't pay its bills. Very strange. Well, anyway, that's all I have for today for this part. For those that are on Radio Al Ansar, I'll continue after the 12 p.m. news. Jazakallah to our engineer at the studio, Hamad, in Lanesia, and to Uncle Hussein Umar here at the Durban studio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.